So I was listening to past episodes to pull an audio segment, and I tell you, I sound like on one of them, and I think it was Fur Girdle. I sound like I'm trying to be a radio host with a soothing voice. I sound like Delilah. Do you remember Delilah?
I do know about Delilah.
Oh. Is she still on?
She might be. Maybe. I never get to listen to the radio, so I have no idea.
Exactly. Well, hey, and we should all be listening to podcasts. So
yeah.
But, okay, I'm going to have to make mental note to Google that. We've probably alienated greater than 50% of the listening audience. Because we're old farts. But anyway, I sound ridiculous. I sound ridiculous. And it was just for that one episode, and then I get back to who you know. Because I don't know who that person was. So, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was the werewolf episode.
Well, that's all right. You were trying to keep us calm through that traumatic Fur Girdle episode. He was eating people and babies.
Spoiler, if you haven't listened to it, that might entice some of you to go back and listen. But hello, I'm not Delilah. I'm Nash.
And I'm Tiff. Hi.
And this is You Totally Made That Up. We're a podcast about crazy, supernatural, paranormal, spooky stories from around the world. And the criteria is that they have to be true. Or at least true to the people who live them. We like to have details. We don't care for the ones that are, you know, people say or the legend has it. We like to know testimonials, and we like to know if there was books written, and we like to know that the Warrens weren't involved. Then it means it's fake. And then, see, I just alienated like another 25% of the listeners.
Well, you know, if they stick with it, they must really love us. And we love you.
And we love you. We do. Oh, talking about that, Tiff and I were talking off mic about this. I encourage everyone, of course, to review. And by that, I mean leave comments if you like. But on the other hand,
everyone loves and appreciates constructive criticism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. On the other hand, you don't have to. I'm happy that you're listening. That's another thing. When I was going back to pull clips, maybe for little audio bites. Of course, they're audio bites. God damn it. For little sound bites is what I meant to say. I thought to myself, I'm going to quit asking them to review. Rate, though. Definitely rate, because that's what pops us up on, you know, listings and stuff that other people can see, like, you know what I'm saying, like in whatever subsection your podcast is listed in. I think we're in life and something. There's no paranormal subcategory, or we absolutely would be in that.
Yeah, you just gotta, you know, click on a star, let us know, and then the pressure's off. Yeah, the pressure's off. You don't have to like worry about leaving comments and praise. I know you want to, but you know. We understand.
Yeah, and not every platform has that option. Like I say, we care that you listen, basically. I thought about this. Of the ratings that we've gotten, one person, and I want to thank you, one person, if you're still listening, you gave us 4 out of 5 stars, and I kind of like that. It was honest.
Because
at the time they left it, I think they were the second or first review. At the time that they left it, that is spot on. And hell, we're still probably trying to get to 5 stars in reality. The rest of you are very kind to kind of preemptively give us the 5, because you know we're going to be a 5. We might be a 5 already. I'm just saying.
We're working on it.
We're working on it. Always room to improve. Here's something else good you guys are doing. Thank you for the influx of suggestions for things to hit on with Spooky Snacks. And you guys are about to get 2 of them in October. We are going to blow up October because it's Halloween month. And you'll have something every week. You're going to have 2 regular episodes and then 2 mini episodes in between. We've already got 1 in the can. And then another one is hopefully going to be a Tiff adventure. Do we want to tell about that yet? I kind of don't want to spoil them.
Not yet. Not until I've got a few more things like solidified. But yeah, it's going to be a fun one. I'm excited.
Well, but you already did one adventure, and by the time y'all are listening to this episode, it'll probably be up on Twitter and Instagram already. But go ahead. You want to tell them where you went?
I did go on an adventure, and I can't believe I survived. I went deep into the closet in my house, and I opened up that scary crawl space door, and I was not disappointed, I'll tell you that. I mean, I'm definitely glad that I did not find any mysterious buckets or dead bodies or weird electrical rigging. Anything like that. I did find a few things in the far corners that I did not go to. And that's mostly because there's so much spiderweb action going on in there that some parts of it look like the fake, like the Halloween kind of web that you spread over bushes and stuff outside. I was like, I didn't know that things ever actually got like that. I thought it was just really bad movie props. But no, that's what's going on in there. So another day when someone else, meaning my husband, goes in there and maybe sweeps some of that out, I'll crawl across, I'll army crawl and see what's going on in the corners because, yeah, I think there's some more hidden goodies in there, but I'm not that adventurous just yet.
And for you guys who don't know what we're referring to, you got to listen to the last episode. And it'll paint the picture real nice as to why Tiff was kind of hesitant to open up that door.
Yeah, go check out Buckets in the Attic. Yeah, you're going to want to probably check your own house after that one, too.
Oh, 100%. Last thing before you get to start it on your story is just to remind you guys, we're at Twitter at YTMTU Podcast. And we are on Instagram at You Totally Made That Up. And we're on Tumblr also at You Totally Made That Up. So come follow us. What I'm aiming to do, and you'll see it up on Twitter. As a matter of fact, I think I've got it as the pinned tweet. I messed around with pulling a little sample. That's what I was talking about earlier, pulling some clips. And I pulled some from the Carl episode, the infamous Carl episode, which is our highest downloaded episode. I love you guys so much for that.
For good reasons. That's such a good one.
For good reason. That is just a whirlwind of a episode. And I pulled a clip from that and put it up with captions. You guys can go see it. It's just a little mini video. So I'm going to try to start doing those from here on out and putting them up on Instagram too. So go check that out and follow us. And that's it. That's all we got for catch up. So on to our stories. Here's the topic. It's back to school time. And what better way to celebrate than stories about creepy children?
Mm-hmm. Well, mine is, it's kind of, it's creepy stuff that happens around children and some paranormal action inside of a school. So that's where I went with my back to school theme. So now when you send your kids off to school, there's so much that people have to worry about. You got to make sure you've got your supplies. You got to make sure that they're set and ready to go and listen to a teacher. There's lots of questions that you ask. You know, you worry about school safety. You worry about making sure that there are enough teachers within the school, technology that they're using. And another thing that you may want to consider is asking whether or not the school is haunted. I don't know if anyone else has thought of this, but it's probably something to check out. When I was originally researching, I did come across like several lists about schools that were haunted and kind of looked into them. Some of them were pretty shaky. Some of them were, oh, this one particular thing happened one time and blah, 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 the school's haunted. But this one has a pretty killer backstory that I feel like gives it some legitimacy. No matter what you say, Nash.
I was about to say, don't realtors have to disclose if there's been a... Is it just a death or is it specifically murder? Or if
I'm
there was
sure.
A death under suspicious circumstances or... I don't know. Maybe it varies state to state or county to county or something. But I know that they have to... I know for sure they have to disclose if there was a murder in the house.
Do we have any realtors listening? Could you tell us?
Realtors, please write in.
Yeah.
And yeah, but you're right. Schools, how the heck would you know unless you purposefully sought it out? So,
yeah. So here's a little bit of history about the land that's now located on Lees Creek Road in Asheville, North Carolina. The deed to the property dates to 1834 and states in part that the land should be kept forever in trust for the use and benefit of the poor of the county of Buncombe. So there was a building at this site. They used to give the welfare handouts from that location. And then there were even some residents that lived there who were sickly and otherwise unable to care for themselves. Now, this poorhouse was eventually closed, and the land was sold and divided in 1846. And the poorhouse was combined with the jail. And the conditions in the poorhouse and the jail were so bad that one inmate escaped after 3 weeks because of the shitty housing situation. And I mean, I don't know how picky you actually get to be when you're a criminal, but when you'd rather like be on the run in 1846 and escape than stay there, I imagine it was pretty bad. So then there's a little bit of a gap in the history there because, you know, records weren't that great, and it was, you know, they were kind of working on the public schooling system and trying to figure out how to work in the welfare and history, you know, laws are changing, blah, blah, blah. I looked way more into it than I needed to, but it is kind of an interesting history about welfare and how that changed from the church to the state. But 1906, and the Buncombe County Home for the Poor was built. That was later moved into the building that used to house the Buncombe County Boys Training School, which was a home for delinquent boys. Now, during the 40s, some of those boys were asked to plow some of the land. And when the supervisor went to check on them, they found that they had discovered several graves and had taken the skulls and put them onto fence posts. They did get the boys to put them back, and then a few years later, the building became the county home for the aged.
I like that. They did get the boys to put them back. Oh, well, good.
Yeah, good boys. You're learning. Yeah. So now, you know, this land has gone from being like a poorhouse to the jail, to the home for delinquent children, to home for the aged. And, you know, all of those groups, what they have in common is that they're more likely poor, they're destitute, they're sickly, are orphaned. So we can imagine how well they were all treated during their time and how well they were treated after they passed. So out back from the buildings, there's the Potter's Field, which is also known as a pauper's cemetery, where, of course, the poor and the wardens of the county and the unclaimed and the prisoners were all buried. All of the folks who, you know, couldn't afford a burial were all interred there, and not very well. Some of the burials were discovered to be only like 7 inches below ground. Some of the bodies were just buried in blankets or other cloth, and there were even some mass graves due to the TB epidemic that broke out in the early part of the century. And again, none of the graves were marked because, once again, there's no money. So there's not very good records of how many people died, who all died, where they're buried, anything like that. And all of this actually continued up until 1972 or possibly 1973. One of those years was when the burials actually stopped in the cemetery. And the home for the aged had been shut down, and the building became the County Emergency Services Center. Now it's 1973. The school district decides, hey, you know what? We need a new campus for the high school. And so they're thinking to themselves, that plot of land behind the current school would be pretty great. I hope at least one person kind of looked at it and said, wait, that land is already being used as a cemetery. Maybe we should look somewhere else. But as things go, I'm sure somebody else said, no, those were poor people, no one cares, and we can just move them, no big deal, meeting adjourned. So that's what happened. September 1973, the school board hired contractors to relocate the cemetery. The cost was $79.99 per grave. So they had looked over the land, the contractors were like, easy peasy, there's like, I don't know, 200 graves there. They start digging, and it becomes obvious nearly immediately that that estimate was way too low. And according to one news article, quote, my guess would be over 1,000 people were buried there, according to Ruth Dilling, who is with the Buncombe County Genealogical Society. And when the school district ran out of money, they just decided to stop moving the bodies. And they ran out of money pretty quickly. By October 30th, the school board voted unanimously to stop further grave removals because there was not enough money that they needed for all of the excavations. And at this point, the contractor had moved around 600 graves, but there were still an estimated 250 to 300 graves at the old site that were just going to be left there. And there's even a chart attached to the deed that's now on file at the Genealogical Society that shows hundreds of numbered grave sites that were moved, but there are also two large areas with the notation cemetery area not moved.
Well, that's the perfect place for the kindergartner's playground.
Right.
Right.
Right. It is. And the bodies that they did move, I mean, a lot of it at this point, you know, it's really badly. They're decomposed. They're skeletons. So what they did with those was they put them into tiny wooden boxes that were about 3 feet long and reburied them. And again, still, they're not marked because there were no grave markers to begin with, and just moved them across the street to another small field. But not all of the bodies were skeletons because, remember, up until 72, the cemetery was still in use. There was just this combination as they were kind of just plowing through the land because it was really scattered how they put these bodies in there. And so in one spot, there could be a skeleton that had been there since 1835. And then next to it is somebody who was buried in 1965. And they're still going to be rotting. And it's going to be unpleasant when you pop open that box or that blanket or whatever it is that they've been buried in. And it was so disturbing that one of the grave diggers that worked with the contractor said that he was leaving the business once the job was over. He was like, nope, I'm out. I do not want to be part of this anymore. Thank you very much. There were, thankfully, a good number of people that ended up kind of disturbed by the whole process. A lot of the school officials that were involved, when they were interviewed for the sources that I found, they didn't want to be identified because they were worried about repercussions. But this one particular retired assistant principal, and I love that they put these notes in here because I'm sure somebody was able to quickly figure out who this was. But he had worked for 17 years at the old campus and then 18 years at the new campus. So this mysterious assistant principal said, "My first thought was they didn't need to move the graveyard in the first place. None of the schools directly built on it. The cemetery was between the fence of the football field and down onto the bank right above the third floor of the school. In my opinion, they could have built the school in there and never had to move any of the graveyard." Which, okay, but you still have like a graveyard kind of in between areas on campus, which
yeah, it's
still
in between.
Doesn't seem...
It's in between. Yeah. It's not like it's between the football field and a bunch of undeveloped woods or something.
Right.
Right? Did I hear that right? He's saying it's
yeah.
It's like from the window of the cafeteria, you could see, you know, a little hand sticking up out of the ground and then the quarterback throwing a pass to it. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't really sure what he was getting at there. I mean. I guess I kind of get it, but my other thought is, did you guys really have to build there at all? So they move along with all these plans with moving the grades, building the new campus, and they build the school, which is known as Clyde A. Irwin High School. They build the football field, they build all that fun stuff. The old school ends up becoming the middle school, and all of the remains that they did get out of the cemetery got moved to a small plot that's actually across the street from the middle school. So again, there's kids just playing around all these dead bodies and cemeteries. Which, you know, that does happen. My grade school was across the street from a cemetery. But there was, like, distance there, and we didn't have to move the cemetery to be there. So some of the excavations were still going on while the school was being built. And one teacher actually took students out to watch as a grave was excavated. This particular one, when opened, revealed a woman that had decayed. They could still see that she had had red hair. She was wearing like a long flowy gown, and in her arms was a deceased infant.
This is insanity.
Yeah.
This is insanity. If I was a parent of one of those children, they would never hear the end of it. I would complain as loudly and as far up the ladder to the press. And I'm not the type to stir shit up, but in that event, that teacher, oh, I'd have had her ass.
Right?
That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
I know. I'm sitting there thinking, like, okay, it's one thing for a kid to, like, reconstruct a little mouse skeleton when you have to take apart the owl pellet. But to just go and casually be like, come on,
wait,
kids.
What the shit are you talking about?
You didn't have to do that in biology?
You took apart an owl and found a mouse? What did you
say? No. An owl pellet, you know, like, so they eat it.
No, I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
Okay, so owls, you know, they eat the little rodents and all the little things. And, but when they're digesting it, like the bones and other larger fragments kind of, they get regurgitated. So, I know my son already did this.
The fuck is going on in Wisconsin?
So we were all given owl pellets and little scalpels and tweezers, and we had to go through and find the skeleton and try to put it together as best that we could.
What's an owl pellet? What is that?
It's what they regurgitate.
It's called a pellet?
Yeah. It's like all the bones and the hard stuff that they can't digest that they regurgitate. So you can see what the owl's diet was. And no?
No! We in high school, I was probably like a junior. I was old. And, well, old. Older than your kids. We were given like these little dried out formaldehyde frogs that you could barely get the scalpel through to dissect. And they were of such poor quality, you couldn't discern anything from anything. So you just basically copied from the book into your workbook what things should be, and then you get an A, and then you move on with life. We weren't they did not distribute owl vomit and say, put a mouse back together.
You missed out.
Listeners, am I off the beam here? Please write in and tell me if I am just totally off the beam. I'm dying.
I can't believe that's what's got you. Out of all the things I said so far, you've had the most to say about owl pellets.
I'm dying.
Oh, I swear to God, it's a thing.
Hey, here's some bear scat. Let's see if you can put a human back together.
We did frogs. We did, what else? Worms, which is pretty boring.
Worms. We did worms.
Yeah, dissection. The owl
pellets. Again, useless. It's mush. You can't see anything.
Yeah. But yeah, so back to Irwin High School here. They had a pretty amazing budget. They're dissecting people. Here, have some remains. See if you can put this person back together. God, I forgot where I was now. All right. So now, I mean, you kind of have a checklist here that you've got desecrated remains. You've got kind of restless spirits. You know, I imagine the combination of people who died from TB and old prisoners and children that were at the boys' home. Their spirits are all there, and they're probably not very happy about all of this. And then on top of that, you've got children that are all over the place. So, yeah, the school's haunted. The school is super haunted. And it's not even like a regular ghost. They have a poltergeist. At least one. I don't know if any of this reminds you of the plot for Poltergeist. But yeah, you know, we've got people building on top of these graves, not moving all of them, and then poltergeist and horrible activity happening and affecting the children. Now, from what I read, the Poltergeist movie was not based on this. It was based on another family that was actually really, really boring. But, at least it wasn't officially based on it. Who's to say that there wasn't somebody who at least had kind of heard about this and things going on? I don't know. But don't not know, right?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. I'm comfortable.
All right, we're going with it. So the poltergeist was pretty active all throughout the school, and teachers would talk about objects flying across classrooms. Janitors said that they heard noises at night, and it would sound like there were even people trying to break into the school, but when they would go and search out the area, they wouldn't find anything. Televisions would turn on unexpectedly, trash cans would move around, get flipped over, pictures flew off the walls, a VCR tape ejected on its own. And the elevator would also move up and down on its own without any passengers. So a former student who had graduated in 88 went to make a short video about all of the ghost legends. And it was meant to be kind of good-humored, kind of jokey for a fundraiser. But when they were filming, they actually experienced some ghost activity. So, like mentioned before, there's kind of that hill and the small field behind the football field where there's the field that contains some of the unmoved remains. So one source said that if you walk there at night, you can see some of the bare spots in the grass that appear to look like shapes of human bodies. So this former student slash filmmaker slash whatever paranormal investigator by the name of Chad Nesbitt says they staked out a coach's office above the media room, not far from a hillside where the bodies remain buried. Nesbitt said most of the bodies remain in an area that's about 100 feet by 100 feet and located directly behind the concession stand of the football field. When we cut the lights off, we saw a bright blob that went across the room, Nesbitt said. At one point, I was the only person in the room, and I heard the sound of someone whistling or humming. We saw what looked like a floating head. I know it sounds crazy, but we could not have any explanation for it. And then another testimony comes from another anonymous employee. So Friday, the rest of the school was at the football stadium for a homecoming game, and this custodian, who just goes by R, and two other custodians were taking a break inside the school. They were one level below a hallway where all of the doors were left open. So R says, we were sitting downstairs and we heard all of the doors slam, just like that. We thought it couldn't have been the cannon, which got fired when somebody on the home team makes a touchdown, because our football team's not the greatest. They ran upstairs and discovered that all of the doors were closed. Now, these doors all had kind of heavy-duty shock absorbers to prevent them from being slammed by the wind or bratty students or angry teachers, whoever. But yeah, so they had gone up there and they could not have any explanation for why all of the doors had slammed shut simultaneously and so loudly. Now, a lot of people knew about the haunting and the poltergeist activity and they had fun with it. So the football team, like R said, they're not very good. They had a four-year losing streak, and they had lost like 33 games in a row. So for one halftime show during the losing streak throughout the 90s, the marching band actually conducted a mock exorcism.
Okay, that's pretty great.
That's pretty fantastic. Good for them. At least they had a good attitude about it. Apparently the team still did not win. But other things that do happen, they've got motion detectors, they go off at night, they still have all of the weird kind of shadows, still things that move around. There was an expansion on the school in the 90s too, and so they said that they've had an uptick in activity following that. Now the county has no plans to excavate the rest of the site or remove any more of the skeletons. So 1973, when they originally did this, each grave was $79.99 to excavate and move. And so based on today's figures, it could be at least $500 per grave today. They said that it would also be unseemly and logistically difficult. So one quote said, number one, we can't swear that there are any left, which is total bullshit. And we don't know exactly where they are. It would be like moving an ancient cemetery. Which I'm just like, we have the technology. we can figure this out, I think.
And since they're unclaimed, I mean, it's sad, but it's the truth. They're unclaimed. Pull them up, put them in a small, container. Like, we all have storage containers with snap lids in our homes. Put them in there, assign them a number, send them to the crematorium. You now have, do you know what I'm saying? Like, you don't have to have a big 6x whatever grave plot. I don't understand that logic either.
Mm-hmm. So that is the story of the poltergeist at Irwin High School in Asheville, North Carolina, which I'm just like, you guys, you're moving schools around, you're moving cemeteries around. You've got it right in the middle of the high school campus. There's all these children. You know, children just invite weird things to happen. Children just invite weird spirits and energies. It's just not, I think it's a bad idea. It's a bad, bad idea. So make sure that you are double checking that your school's not haunted, you guys. Just putting that out there. So what do you have for our back to school stories?
Well, I have creepy children.
Hooray!
Hooray. All right. I take you to England, Suffolk, a little village called Woolpit. Not because their chief export was wool, but because they had a shitload of big assholes in the ground called wolf pits, and somebody substituted an O for an F. You know, normal village.
Right, of course.
The year is anywhere between 1135 and 1154, or a little before, or a little after. It doesn't matter. What matters is, imagine you're out in the fields harvesting, and two children who were dressed real weird wander out of the woods. And it just so happened that they are green. Think summer leaves. Think clovers. Think Kermit. And I hope that the song It's Not Easy Being Green is now running through y'all's minds, because I am a horrible person.
Uh-huh.
Now,
thank you.
I don't know. What?
I said thanks a lot for that now.
Thanks. That's what I'm here for. Now, I don't know what I'd do in such a situation, but these farmers tried to talk to the kids and explain that whole wolf thing, I imagine, which I'm not letting go of that. And no dice. The kids spoke an odd language they never heard. So they take the kids to a prominent member of town, a dude named Sir Richard de Calne, who lived in a place called Wykes, which was nearby. The adults try to feed the kids, and they refuse, and they keep on refusing for several days. And then they see beans. They went nuts for the beans. They rip open stalks, and they lose their shit crying when there's no beans there. But then somebody opens the pods for them, and they just go to town. Now, I saw green beans, I saw fava beans, I saw peas, whatever. Fava beans were what was associated with the area, and these kids are eating them raw, the thought of which absolutely just hurts my teeth.
Oh.
So the townsfolk slowly get these kids accustomed to food other than beans. And while the girl starts getting better, because apparently they were both sort of malnourished looking and sickly in addition to the green, the boy doesn't get used to everything and start eating and all, and he dies. The girl keeps doing okay. And along the way, she's learning English, and she's working for de Calne as a servant. I'm guessing in exchange for room and board. And once she's able to speak it fluently, they're like, okay, now we have got to know how y'all got here. And, how come you're friggin' green? She's like, here's what went down. And I quote, now I want y'all to check out how magically eloquent and verbose this young lady became. We are inhabitants of the land of St. Martin, who is regarded with peculiar veneration in the country which gave us birth. We are ignorant of how we arrived here. We only remember this, that on a certain day, when we were feeding our father's flocks in the fields, she likes alliteration, we heard a great sound, such as we are now accustomed to hear at St. Edmund's when the bells are chiming. And whilst listening to the sound in admiration, we became entranced and found ourselves among you in the fields where you were reaping. The sun does not shine upon our countrymen. Our land is little cheered by its beams. We are contented with that twilight, which, among you, precedes the sunrise or follows the sunset. Moreover, a certain luminous country is seen, not far distant from ours, and is divided from it by a very considerable river.
Did they live on the moon? Like, what the hell?
I know. So another source puts it a little differently and more concisely. So here's the deal. The same is that she's saying that this St. Martin's place where they were from doesn't really have sunlight, that it's twilight all the time. There's a big river that separates them from a land that has lots of light. They're tending the family's cattle. But a little extra detail is that they wandered off and found caverns, like, you know, this cave system type thing, and that they follow the sound of bells, and that's how they ended up at Woolpit. Now, one place said that it was after this that the brother died. So I'm not sure if he chimed in to the story, because everywhere seems to say it was the girl relating all this. But anyway, after this is told, DeCown had the kids baptized, and then the brother died, is what another place said. So I don't know if maybe somebody threw that in to make everybody feel better that this boy was officially Christian before he died instead of some unknown heathen or whatnot. That's just me speculating. But anyway, it doesn't matter. The girl goes on working for DeCown, and in one place it says he said about her that she was, quote, rather loose and wanton in her conduct. I have no idea what that means.
She's a hoe. It means she's a hoe.
Well, she's supposed to be a preteen at this point, and I don't know who she's supposed to be hoeing it up with. Like, if she's out there, like, in the bean field trying to... I have no idea. So... I assume they christened her with a new name at the baptism, because she was then known as Agnes. And then it said that she ended up marrying a guy who was an archdeacon of Ely or Ellie called Richard Barr, and that they had at least one kid. And apparently that's been a sort of mission for people who are trying to verify this story, is digging into the genealogy to track down an Agnes Barr to prove that this person actually existed. So, all right, there's your basics on the Green Children. Now, the question is, was this some sort of folktale created for some reason, or did something actually happen? And I'm now going to kind of present the evidence and let y'all decide what you believe. So, well, what do you think so far, Tiff? Any thoughts?
I think that there were some picky children who just wanted them to eat something other than beans.
Their parents were like,
if you don't eat your meat, you will become a green, weird child. No, I don't know. I honestly,
their parents said, go forth into the world, children. Find more beans or something other than beans. Yes. All right. So about our sources. First off, we got to ask, who are our sources? And by that, I don't mean my sources. I mean the original deals, as in, where did this story come from? Because this doesn't seem to be a case of people passing down a story verbally and it may be mutating like a game of telephone. This actually has two pretty solid origins that agree with each other in several ways. But on the other hand, are they solid? Yeah. So I'm going to give you the scoop and see what you think. The first record dates to 1189 or 1196 and the other to 1200 or 1220. And I feel like that's a bit of a spread, but one of my sources... And who, boy, is it a source? It's this really in-depth academic article by a dude named John Clark. He calls these sources nearly contemporaneous, which, okay, I'm not a historian, and I don't know. That it seems like a bit of a spread to be contemporaneous, but I don't know the exact... Somebody who is a historian can write in and tell us what the category for contemporaneous would be, like how many years before it is considered... next generation, for lack of a better word. But the guys that wrote these were William of Newburgh, who was from Yorkshire, and Ralph of Coggeshall, who was from North Essex. So, okay. Now we have to ask ourselves where they got their stuff from. William was alive at the time all this happened, but he didn't write his book until the late 1100s. So we're talking about 40 years out. And apparently Agnes had died before he got a chance to track her down or interview her. However, he was really vehement that he had spoken to many people who were there. And he said, quote, "At length, I was so overwhelmed by the weight of so many and such competent witnesses that I have been compelled to believe." More stuff about William. that he seemed to believe includes when he would write up stories. Again, he liked eyewitness testimonials of sources, but he would also try to explain the stories, and frequently he chalked some stuff up to just illusion. So, you know, people's imaginations. Or and I quote, "the result of the machinations of devils or evil angels." And he also liked to tell about ghosts and vampires and revenants. So
he knew what was up. He knew what was going on.
He had a real solid logical beat on things. But he never gave an explanation for the green kids. So thanks, William. As for Ralph, well, here we go again. His book also came out 40-some-odd years after, and it was more like an anthology. And if we assume for a second that this is a true story about the Green Kids, he was mixing facts with some pretty serious woo. The part of his book about the kids is in between a part about a merman and then a report about some giant teeth that were discovered. That's exactly what it said. It was just that vague. He also reported on the existence of giants in England and Wales and about witchcraft and miracles happening in France. Then he'd get back to mixing in actual historical facts. But in terms of where he got the story from, he said that he heard it directly from DeCown, the guy who took in the kids.
Oh, okay. Seems legit.
Seems legit. So supernatural stuff aside, they've each got their own sources. They presented their stuff within a general ballpark of each other. And the stories really are pretty much alike, minus some really fine details that I'm not going to get into. Now, talking about historical accounts, one of my sources points out that this was such a weird, just one-off banana story that you would have thought it would have gotten around pretty quickly. And so the fact that it's missing from other works is kind of odd. One in particular he mentioned called the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, which dealt with, quote, "English history up until the death of King Stephen in 1154 and includes many of the wonders popular at that time." So I take that to mean cuckoo stories, perhaps.
Like the world of the weird, like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, and here's all that was going on, and then, by the way, here's some fun stuff, too. That's the impression I get. But as for me, my point of view is absence of evidence is not evidence. That's just kind of a basic scientific tenet. So I feel like that should hold true in historical science as well. But that's just me. So, okay, here's all the theories. First, the stupid ones, she said, not biased at all. All right, green sickness. Now, we're going to come back to illness and green coloring, but what I specifically mean here is one of those things that people believe afflicted women back in the day, you know, like hysteria, because you know us women's and our lady junk, you got to watch us something careful.
Oh, yeah. It's bad.
Symptoms included paleness and weakness and mostly impacted virgins. And the quick and dirty on this is that until a girl got her period, all her humors were filling up her womb. And does everybody remember or know what humors are? I don't know why I'm asking everybody. You're the only one here. But it was this belief that bile and phlegm and blood were connected to disease and that you had to keep them balanced or it would throw your body and your mind out of whack. And I have just really glossed over that. And I'm doing it from memory, but I'm pretty confident that I'm right. So, you know,
yeah,
don't at me.
Yeah, because people would do like the weird like bloodletting and, you know, different things like that because they wanted to get the ghost
right, right,
out of
right.
blood.
Right, right, right.
Stuff like that.
But for this specifically, talking about remedies, for this specifically, some cures were putting steel into wine, like ground up steel powder with spices and herbs and shit, and you drank it and you get some exercise and it would get your humors flowing. Then another thing, kind of along with the exercise part, was simply not to be slothful. So, okay. Third thing is get laid. Get some sperm in you. And an article that the Mary Sue did on green sickness quoted a hilarious folk song about it, which I shall now read for you.
Yes.
"A handsome, buxom lass lay panting on her bed. She looked as green as grass, and mournfully she said, 'Except I have some lusty lad to ease me of my pain, I cannot live, I sigh and grieve, my life I now disdain. But if some bonny lad would be so kind to me, before I am quite mad, to end my misery, and cool these burning flames of fire which rage in this my breast, then I should be from torments free and forever blessed.'"
I just need somebody to dick me down.
I need a romance novel. Having said that, I don't know about y'all, but I think we can go ahead and toss this out because the brother was affected by the green stuff and the green sickness, supposedly. And so we can throw that to the side. Next up, fairies. Yes, fairies keep following us. Fairies and elves, too, have come up. So Clark, the academic article guy, he poses the question, were fairies an option back in the 1100s in Suffolk? Would the people have wondered at that time, is it fairies? Or is this coming from people looking back who were thinking this and suggesting fairies? And on top of all that, are fairies even considered green? Because, you know, absinthe is nicknamed the green fairy. And so for more modern times, I get why that might be kind of a knee-jerk reaction to think. And by the way, while we're here, for those of you who've never tried absinthe, let me prepare you. It is essentially black licorice in liquid form.
All right, that's nasty.
I tell you, if it's mixed up in stuff, it's tolerable. But I did a shot one time and it burned a trail. Just in inhaling it, I think singed every nose hair. It is stout stuff. You're supposed to like burn a sugar cube over it, melt a sugar cube. I have no idea why I'm telling y'all this. Okay, none of this matters. I keep saying that. I keep telling you guys things and then saying, none of this matters. And then going on to something else.
Guys, Nash likes to party hard, apparently. This is what we're learning here.
I have a sordid past. So, no, I really don't. I'm probably, comparatively by today's standards, painfully boring. So, he talks about how, yeah, fairies have actually been classified with colors from green to white to black to gray to red. And then he throws in this beautiful, beautiful jewel that absolutely cracked me up. Quote, a polychrome fairy dog, which is absolutely now my favorite mythological creature. If any of our listeners want to draw me a polychrome fairy dog, we will happily tweet and Instagram the crap out of that. It would delight me to no end. No pressure. But
that sounds incredible.
But I would totally love to see a polychrome fairy dog.
That's it. That's all there is to it.
I mean, is it like a little weenie dog? I picture it being like a little dog.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, because it's got to be dainty with the wings. That's what I'm thinking.
But a polychrome fairy dog. Oh, I'd love it. My dogs just heard me say dog, and they both just stopped dead and looked in the room. They're not polychrome. So anyway, the thing about the green fairies in particular was that they were known for hanging out around houses and gardens and meadows, and that they reward humans by cleaning their houses and leaving them money and dancing and creating nice little dreams and all that good stuff. And Clark points out also that green could have meant more the kids' disposition. So like the girl becoming a house servant and, you know, kids in general just being cheerful, chipper little creatures. And it could have been, well, you know, I know. Let's just roll with that. So another, oh, and he also said, and maybe it's just that their clothes were green. You know, we don't know.
That's too simple.
It's too simple. It's a little too simple. That's why I was like,
Nope, I don't buy it.
Another thing to consider is that fairy could have just been representative of them being other, as an otherworldly, because in stories about otherworldly beings, similar details would always be mentioned, like unusual physical characteristics. So in this case, for the kids, it would be skin color, and also language and clothing, things like that. So there's kind of a parallel there too. So the green kids fit this bill of otherworldly. And on that note, aliens. Insert yes. Meme of dude with crazy hair.
Aliens.
No, really. So there's talk of the kids being teleported, quote, through a vortex in space from a parallel universe or subterranean existence on another planet, perhaps Mars. Then here's another
just
quote for you.
Tossing it out there. Maybe Mars.
Maybe Mars. Here's another one. Quote, or they wandered through tunnels from an inhabited world within our own, the base from which flying saucers also emerge. I mean, holy fuck noodles, y'all. What is happening? And several of my sources mentioned this one guy in particular, last name of Lunan, and he's an astronomer. And this was published in a science fiction magazine. He says that maybe the kids were somehow accidentally transported, quote, from their home planet as a result of a matter transmitter malfunction. Here's another whamdinger quote about him. Lunan suggests that the planet from which the children were expelled may be trapped in synchronous orbit around its sun, presenting the conditions for life only in a narrow twilight zone between a fiercely hot surface and a frozen dark side. He explains the children's green coloration as a side effect of consuming the genetically modified alien plants eaten by the planet's inhabitants. Now, very specific.
I like it.
I mean, I've heard less specificity and like grounded theories, much less. So, and you'll notice that I've quoted a lot, and it's because I just don't want this stuff coming out of my mouth with my own words, because I don't like having stupid in my mouth, quite frankly. I understand that my dating history would indicate the contrary, but I digress. So, the bizarre thing about this dude, Lunan, and that article was in 1996, is that apparently he has done a shit ton of legit work, because in a 2012 book he wrote, he's done all this research on the genealogy of Agnes's husband, Richard Barr, and he's been trying to track down DeCown's family too, and all this stuff about the politics and the life at the time. But the problem is he's working it in with stuff about aliens abducting humans, and he even has stuff in there about some conspiracy with King Henry II and the Knights Templar having something to do with aliens. And basically his end game is that these kids are part of a human colony of alien abductees. Anyway, I most certainly did not seek that book out. I'm trusting my sources here, but if you are so inclined, this masterpiece is called A Speculative Treatment of Medieval History. I mean, he calls it speculative, so there's...
He's honest. He's props. At least honest with that title.
Much props. Okay, so we are not giving this even one more moment of time. Moving on. The last bit of speculation as to where the hell these kids came from is actually a decently plausible one, which is that they were abandoned in the woods. And we'll come back to that. First thing, though, let's cover the green skin stuff. For some reason, arsenic poisoning comes up if you look into this. And I don't know why that's even entertained, because you're not going frog if you ingest arsenic. So we're not going to go down that road. Second thing, let's talk about some actual reasons for the green skin. And they're a little weak for the most part, but it's more plausible than aliens and fairies. And so for that reason, here we go. For one thing, how green was green? Now, William and Ralph both called it viridis, which is Latin for green. But then later, Ralph called it proscenium colorum, which means leek color. And y'all that have seen a leek, you know, the vegetable, know what we're talking about. Like, it's maybe faintly green depending on its age, but it's mostly this kind of cream color. It's somewhat yellow. Mm-hmm. And when you take that into account, it opens up some more possibilities for medical conditions. And just to rattle off some that y'all might be thinking of, at least are the ones that I think of, might be jaundice, which gives this kind of sallow complexion, which can come from hepatitis, and it includes the sclera of the eyes. And another one might be anemia, so low red blood cell count, and you're pale. And anemia wasn't uncommon at all in medieval times. Skeletons have borne this out. So then there's malnutrition, of course. So you've got that iron deficiency, that B12 deficiency. And, you know, hell, like we covered in another episode, if your family tree doesn't fork enough, or if there's too much breeding within an isolated population, hereditary anemia can pop up with more regularity than you'd think. And, I mean, we don't know anything about these kids, so I'm just throwing that one out there, too.
Yeah.
Now, here's where I'm going to disagree with all these experts who have looked into this, because for the most part, they've outright dismissed anemia because of the skin color thing. They're just being so adamant that it was green and not on the yellow spectrum, and ignoring that whole leak thing I mentioned, as well as ignoring what the evidence of, you know, like bones say. There's a term you'll see come up called chlorosis, which is an antiquated, obsolete medical term. And here's how the dictionary, and I mean a medical dictionary, describes it. Quote, a greenish tinge to the skin formerly associated with severe iron deficiency anemia in malnourished young women. It is now almost unknown in developed countries. So I don't get why they're just tossing this aside just because we don't see it today with great regularity doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, or didn't exist, rather. There's one other thing, and it has to do with the beans. It's called favism, and it's a hereditary thing to do with a missing enzyme. And essentially, it causes toxicity due to ingesting beans, particularly, guess what, fava beans. But it's an allergy, and it can even kick off from bean plant pollen, which I didn't know or I forgot that bean plant pollen was a thing. And it causes an acute onset of hemolytic anemia. So that's where the red blood cells are there, but the cell walls break down and they lyse, L-Y-S-E. So they ain't in circulation, ergo anemia. Now, it's not terribly common nowadays statistically, but it still is within certain subgroups. And I saw noted were Italy, Sardinia, and the Middle East, particularly Pakistan. And it's most common in young boys. And guess what? You get pale and jaundiced and fatigued. And if it gets as far as kidney failure, then definitely you got to get on top of it because that'll kill you. Mm. So we might have a good answer there for the brother if he was so far gone that he wasn't able to get going again once he started eating right. Or even if he did, if his kidneys were failing, I mean, it's the damn 1100s. You're done. Yeah. Now, third thing to look at is their language and supposedly weird clothing. The language can be chalked up to any language with which a small village isn't familiar. As far as the clothes, specifically, William had said they were dressed in a clothing of an unusual color made of an unknown material.
Like space material.
Yeah. Okay. So yes, tinfoil is exactly what happened. Green tinfoil. Now, there's a thought that these kids are Flemish. We'll get to that in a second. And the clothing comes into play in terms of that because an author by the name of Paul Harris, and you know what? I went ahead and cited him in show notes just for good measure since everybody and their mother references this dude. He asserts that the Flemish at this time had pretty badass weaving skills, and the immigrants, of course, brought those skills with them, along with how they would use dyes that weren't available in medieval England. And it's not like East Bumdoodle Wolfpit was some huge trading hub, so they weren't exactly exposed to a variety of fashion coming through like they did in the port towns. But could they have been? Hold that thought. Harris lays out a pretty reasonable scenario, which I shall now share with you. If the children appeared a little later in the 1100s, specifically in the 1170s, then this fits within a Flemish immigration from Belgium. And this had been an ongoing immigration, mostly weavers and merchants. And when King Henry II started ruling, they came under some really heavy persecution and they suffered a lot of casualties. One time in particular at a battle, I mean, it was a legit battle between Flemish mercenaries and I assume crown soldiers at Fornham, which is in Suffolk, and it was like thousands of people. And there happens to be a village there called, guess what, St. Martin. And it happens to be several miles from Woolpit across, you guessed it, Lark River.
Ooh.
So what if the kids' parents had been killed and they start off scared into the forest and they're getting malnourished and blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. And Harris proposes that maybe they heard the bells at St. Edmunds, followed the noise, then got into these flint mine passages that go all the way back to Neolithic times. I mean, they're there. It's confirmed that these things exist. So they get lost in those, and then they pop out at Woolpit like they've just appeared out of nowhere, all weird looking and talking funny. Sounds good.
It's a journey. Holy crap.
It's a journey, but I'm tracking with it.
Yeah.
But here's the problem. Talking about villagers not being exposed to other cultures, that might be, but the big dogs in the community, like the man who took them in, Richard DeCown, he would have been educated and been aware of the immigration and probably would have recognized Flemish. For another thing, Woolpit wasn't actually all that isolated. They were located beside a route that was used as a to and from by two major ports. Plus, they were close to a bigger town called Bury St. Edmunds that had trade fairs where foreign merchants would come, along with local merchants too, of course. And fairs would happen like four times a year, you know, once a season. And the St. James Fair in particular would happen in July, which is when the kids were found. And we know that because the harvest was happening. So on one hand, this kind of goes against the Woolpit folks being unexposed and backwoods, but on the other hand, maybe the kids were part of a merchant family and wandered off. Having said that, I then have to ask, wouldn't you be going to all the neighboring villages hunting for your kids?
Nah.
Okay, well then, we'll move on. No. Depends on the kid, right?
I suppose, yeah. I mean,
if they were eating all the beans. So As far as the thought about maybe their parents died in that battle, one of my sources points out that it had been real strange for these fighters to have brought their families along. Counterpoint, what if they also happened to live nearby and the Crown soldiers, you know, went on a raid or something? I have no idea. I'm just spitballing. I will say this, though. Talking about the persecution angle, John Clark brought up an interesting thought, and I really, really took a shine to this. He brought up, what if perhaps DeCown totally did recognize that these kids were Flemish, and he just played along to protect them from getting persecuted? And I really liked that. So perhaps they did wander off, get lost. Who knows? Maybe they had old parents and the parents died. We have no idea. But what if he hid them on purpose? Because, you know,
yeah,
it's not like you can say, hey, here, call your mom and dad. And a couple other things that don't quite wash, though, with Harris's scenario. Given the location of this forest called the Thetford Forest to Bury St. Edmunds, there's no way that the kids could have heard the church bells. And as far as the mines go, there aren't any passages that lead directly to Woolpit. These major flint mines that would have had passages like that were up in Grimes Graves, which is about 20 miles north from Bury St. Edmunds. And plus, if there are these malnourished sick kids, the 50-kilometer walk from St. Martin to Woolpit would have been super tough, because that's a little over 30 miles. I mean, I couldn't do that right now as I sit here and I ain't malnourished.
These are hardy medieval children, okay, Nash? Don't discard them.
But they're green. I submit that I might not know the answers to what's going on, but they green. Something's up. So I have no idea where all the detail of this story comes from, or how two separate dudes, years and miles apart, ended up with pretty much the same story. What I do know is that there's a quote I ran across from a historian named Derek Brewer, who, in very much my style, plays the Occam's razor card, and he goes, quote, "The likely core of the matter is that these very small children, herding or following flocks, strayed from their forest village, spoke little, and, in modern terms, didn't know their own home address."
Aww.
Go, Derek. All right.
Yeah.
There you go. But I conclude all this. I know it's not fun. Derek, damn it. Your answer's not fun. It's not fun, but it's the most logical. Now, I will close off with this. The last thing I'll say, if this is just some folktale that mutated, given what was going on at the time with this Flemish immigration upset, and, you know, let's call a spade, superiority attitudes, the being otherworldly thing that we talked about, it might have been a way to teach lessons, which that's what fairy tales are supposed to do. And basically trying to get across that, you know, people are people. They may look differently than you and speak what sounds like gibberish to your ears and dress bizarrely and eat things that you think are weird, but it doesn't mean that they're monsters. It doesn't mean that they're creatures. It doesn't mean that they're aliens. They're just different.
Can we cue the Full House Meaningful Moment music and have Danny Tanner?
We've just had a special. Shut up. Thank you for tuning into this episode, special episode of You Totally Made That
this
Up.
This after school special. Oh, it's perfect. It ties right in.
I know we can't sing any theme songs or we'll get copyright infringed. But,
you guys imagine it. Just, you know, think it in your head and smile and be like, yep, I know what they're saying.
See, they're happy it's not easy being green is out of their heads. And now I've just brought it up again. So
thanks. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. You're welcome, everybody. You're welcome. That's it. We've covered don't bury body. Don't let your children go to school where there's bodies buried out back, preferably. If at all possible. If so, if their teacher takes them on a field trip to see said bodies unearthed, gonna want to report that.
Yeah, probably. Just make sure they stick to the owl pellets, which is totally a thing, Nash. I swear to God.
I'm gonna look this up, damn it. And if there's some instructional YouTube video, by God, it's going in show notes. Oh, all the show notes are back at the blog, by the way. I don't know if we mentioned it. They're back at the blog. We source. We're not at all, you know, bringing that up very heavy-handedly because of anything in the media currently revolving around podcasts. No, not at all. The casual. That was a casual drop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cash. So, yeah, we've learned that. We've learned that you can open up owl puke to find treasures. And
Jesus, it's so disgusting. My son brought his home. He had it all like glued to a piece of paper and brought it home. I was like, here.
Well, ain't you proud?
I was so proud. I was so, so proud. It was, I was like, this is great, honey. I displayed it for a day and then it disappeared. I have no idea what could have happened to it.
It's probably in that hidey hole that's up in your...
Right?
That's what it is. The man that lives in your hidey hole came out and said, I would like this piece of art for Chateau crawl space. I'll put it right over my bucket.
Right over my bucket. Yep. Gotta have something to look at.
And what else have we got?
We've got the poly...
green children. Now you know what to do.
Fairy dog. Oh, I'm so excited about that fairy dog.
I'm real excited about that fairy dog, y'all.
I'm like...
please, somebody draw it.
Imagining this beautiful, like, stained glass dog, almost.
Yeah, polychromatic. I can't even call up in my mind what that would even begin to look like. But that's why I'm not a graphic artist.
That's exciting.
And between the owls and the dogs, we've got a nice little... I don't know. I've got my choices for the title of the episode are multitude.
Yeah, you're going to have a hard time selecting things here.
I think though that about wraps it up, and I hope that those of you who are parents are happy that your season has come, that the children are now out of the house for about 8 hours a day, and bless you.
Yes, and good luck to all the teachers, because, oh boy, you need it. Especially if, you know, there are lots of graveyards either near or underneath your schools.
Between the corpses and the owl vomit and the green skin, I feel like your plates overfloweth.
Yeah. Teachers deserve all the gift cards, you guys.
I have no idea. Not a sponsor. We're not sponsored by any gift card companies. But anyway.
We're not. It's just
That's
a fact.
It.
It's just a fact. But yeah, so enjoy your back to school season and watch where you're stepping. And lay off the beans, I guess. I don't know. I think you might go green.
And lay off the beans. Those are excellent parting words. And that's it for us. We're out of here, folks. Stay spooky.
Bye. Thanks so much for listening. As a reminder, you can check out our sources for each of the episodes at show notes, along with any supplemental things we think you might enjoy.
Visit us on our blog at youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com. You can also find us on Twitter at YTMTUpodcast and on Instagram at youtotallymadethatup. Feel free to contact us on those platforms, and you can also email us. That address is youtotallymadethatup@gmail.com.